Welcome to HN Pod, your daily audio deep dive into the top stories from Hacker News. I am Sarah.
And I'm Mike. Today is Thursday, April 16th, 2026, and you are listening to episode 367. As always, we are bringing you the most interesting discussions and trending articles from yesterday, April 15th.
We have a really packed and diverse lineup for you today. We are going to talk about a major privacy controversy involving Google and ICE, a surprisingly poetic photo essay about minerals, a classic debate on the best way to learn how to write a compiler, a huge legal blow to Live Nation, and finally, a fascinating breakdown of why your trusty backpack just does not last like it used to.
Let us jump right into the top story. This one got over 1,200 points and sparked a massive debate. The title is, Google Broke Its Promise to Me, Now ICE Has My Data. It comes from an Electronic Frontier Foundation guest post by Amandla Thomas Johnson.
Right. So the background here is that Thomas Johnson is a dual British and Trinidadian citizen who was a PhD candidate studying in the US on a student visa. Back in late 2024, he attended a pro-Palestinian protest at Cornell University. Fast forward to April 2025, and Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, sent Google an administrative subpoena for his account data.
And here's where the broken promise comes in. Google has had a long-standing policy of notifying users before handing their data over to law enforcement, specifically to give those users a chance to legally challenge the subpoena. But in this case, Google just handed over the information. Thomas Johnson only found out weeks later, when he was already out of the country in Geneva, Switzerland, and received an email from Google basically saying, hey, we already gave your data to the Department of Homeland Security.
The EFF is now stepping in, sending complaints to the California and New York attorneys general, asking them to investigate Google for deceptive trade practices. The data handed over included his IP addresses, physical addresses, and session times. Even without the actual content of his emails, that is enough to build a very intimate surveillance profile.
The Hacker News comments on this were incredibly insightful, especially regarding the legal mechanics of these subpoenas. A lot of people initially wanted to give Google the benefit of the doubt, assuming that maybe the subpoena came with a strict non-disclosure order, commonly known as a gag order. But as several commentators pointed out, and as the ACLU has documented, ICE administrative subpoenas do not actually have the legal authority to enforce gag orders.
Exactly. One commenter highlighted that tech companies often overcomply with these requests. They are not forced to stay quiet, and they are not legally required to provide more assistance than the bare minimum. But fighting it takes time and money, so the path of least resistance is just to hand the data over and keep the user in the dark until it is too late.
There was also a really interesting legal debate in the comments about First Amendment rights for non-citizens. Some people were questioning if he even had those protections, but as one user pointed out, the Supreme Court has ruled that the Due Process Clause and First Amendment protections apply to all persons within the United States, whether their presence is lawful, temporary, or permanent. The government can revoke visas for immigration violations, but using immigration machinery to punish political expression on U.S. soil is a massive overreach.
It is a chilling story, and it really highlights the intersection of state power and corporate data. If you are relying on a massive tech company to protect your privacy based on a corporate promise, you might be in for a rude awakening when the government comes knocking.
Absolutely. Moving on to something a bit lighter, our second story is a beautiful blog post titled God Sleeps in the Minerals. It got nearly 500 points.
This is a post from the Chamblacian blog, and it is essentially a photo essay from the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County. The author took some incredible snapshots at their Unearthed Raw Beauty exhibition. The title itself actually sparked some conversation. A few people were confused or even offended by it, but one commenter clarified that it is a famous quote from Paramahansa Yogananda, who said, God sleeps in the minerals, dreams in the flowers, awakens in the animals, and in man knows that he is awake.
It is a very poetic way to frame the sheer jaw-dropping beauty of these geological formations. The pictures show these massive, perfectly formed crystalline structures that look almost alien, and the Hacker News thread quickly turned into a gathering place for rock hounds.
I loved reading those comments. People were talking about the thrill of going out with an S-wing rock hammer and just smashing rocks to find something mildly interesting. But there was also a bit of lamenting about the hobby. One user pointed out that while the US has great public lands for rock hounding, most of the truly museum-quality specimens are found on private land or during commercial mining operations.
Right. The average person is not going to stumble upon a flawless, boulder-sized crystal on a weekend hike. Though one commenter did push back, saying they recently pulled a plate full of rare tellurites out of a mountain for a Caltech PhD. So the treasures are still out there if you know exactly what to look for and where to look.
My favorite comment from that thread was someone pointing out that the crystalline structure of minerals is actually a macro-scale echo of their atomic arrangement. You are literally seeing a repeating pattern of atoms on a scale large enough to hold in your hand. It is one of those thoughts that just makes you appreciate the physical world a little bit more.
It really does. Okay, from the physical world to the virtual, our third story is a blast from the past that always gets the Hacker News crowd fired up. It is a post from 2008 by James Haig titled, "Want to Write a Compiler? Just Read These Two Papers."
If there is one thing software engineers love to argue about, it is how to learn about compilers. Haig's whole premise is that standard compiler textbooks are way too dense and broadly scoped. He specifically calls out the famous Dragon Book, which is practically a rite of passage, or a trauma, depending on who you ask, in computer science degree programs.
He argues that these massive books spend way too much time on converting regular expressions into state machines and parsing theory, leaving the reader no closer to actually writing a working compiler. Instead, he recommends Jock Crenshaw's legendary 1988 tutorial series called Let's Build a Compiler, which walks you through building a simple compiler in Pascal. He also recommends a paper on the NanoPass framework, which treats a compiler as just a series of dozens of super simple transformations of an abstract syntax tree.
The comments on this one were fantastic. So many people chimed in to say that the Dragon Book almost convinced them to never write a compiler. One user said it completely sucked the joy out of the magical concept of making one until they discovered Forth and built their own compiler in assembly, which brought the magic back.
But the Dragon Book also had its defenders. Some people said Chapter 2 is actually a brilliant, self-contained introduction to the topic. The real consensus in the comments seemed to be that the academic fixation on parser generators and Backus Norform grammars is the problem. Several people advised that if you want to write a compiler today, just write a recursive descent parser by hand. It is way easier than fighting with parser generators.
People also dropped a ton of alternative book recommendations. Nicholas Wirth's short book, simply called Compilers, got a lot of love for its pristine clarity. Another highly recommended one was Lisp in Small Pieces, which teaches you how to build a Lisp compiler without getting bogged down in the weeds of lexing and parsing text. If you've ever wanted to demystify how programming languages actually work, that comment thread is an absolute goldmine of resources.
Definitely bookmark that one. Let us shift gears to some major business and legal news. Our fourth story is a Bloomberg piece titled "Live Nation Illegally Monopolized Ticketing Market, Jury Finds."
This is huge news for anyone who has tried to buy concert tickets in the last decade and felt completely exploited. A jury has found that Live Nation, which owns Ticketmaster, has illegally monopolized the market. The article itself covers the legal victory, but the Hacker News thread really dug into the mechanics of why the ticketing market is so fundamentally broken.
The horizontal control is obvious. Live Nation owns the venues, manages the artists, and runs the ticketing platform. But a commenter pointed out that the bigger issue is the vertical integration of first-party ticket sales and the resale market. Ticketmaster has zero incentive to stop scalpers or bots from buying up all the inventory because they get to charge massive service fees on the initial sale, and then they charge fees again when that same ticket is resold on their own platform.
It is a literal double dip. The more times a ticket changes hands, the more money Ticketmaster makes. The commenters were brainstorming ways to fix this. One interesting idea was a Dutch auction system, where tickets start at an absurdly high price, say $10,000, and the price drops every day until the concert. That forces professional resellers to take on massive risk if they want to hoard inventory.
Another popular suggestion was to just ban the transfer of tickets entirely, treating them like airline tickets. You buy a ticket, your name is on it, and you show your ID at the door. If you cannot go, you get a refund, and the venue resells it at face value.
But there was a lot of pushback on that idea. People pointed out that concert tickets are not national security risks like airplanes. What if you buy four tickets for your friends and one of them gets sick? You should be able to give that ticket to someone else. It is more like a dinner reservation than a flight. The debate really highlighted how hard it is to balance consumer freedom with anti-scalping measures, especially when the platform itself profits from the scalping.
It will be very interesting to see what actual remedies the court imposes now that the monopoly verdict is in. Breaking them up might just be the start.
I hope so.
Speaking of monopolies and corporate consolidation, our final story today is a brilliant piece from a blog called Worse on Purpose. The article is titled, Your Backpack Got Worse on Purpose, and it really struck a nerve, pulling in nearly 400 points.
This article perfectly encapsulates the feeling we all have that physical goods are just getting shoddier. The author, Kiana Sapp, looks specifically at the backpack market. Back in the 80s and 90s, brands like JanSport, The North Face, and Eastpak were fierce competitors. If one made a bad bag, you bought the other. But starting in 1986, a massive conglomerate called VF Corporation quietly bought them all.
By the 2010s, VF Corp controlled over half the U.S. backpack market. And when one parent company owns all the competitors, the pressure to outbuild each other completely evaporates. The only pressure left is to hit margin targets. So they made everything a little bit worse. They dropped the denier count of the fabric, which means using thinner, weaker threads. They swapped out premium YKK Japanese zippers for cheap generic ones. They even reduced the stitch density to save seconds on the assembly line.
And they did it all while keeping the logos crisp and the prices the same, coasting entirely on the brand reputation built decades ago. The article also tears into the famous JanSport lifetime warranty. It used to be legendary. Now you have to pay $20 to ship the bag to them, wait 6 weeks, and they usually deny the claim by calling the failure normal wear and tear. The warranty is structurally designed to exclude the exact type of failure the bag is now engineered to have.
The economics of it are just infuriating. A bag that falls apart in 18 months creates a repeat customer. A bag that lasts 15 years creates zero follow-up revenue. From a shareholder perspective, the garbage bag is the better product.
The Hacker News comments really expanded on this. Someone brought up a video by Donut Media that compared vintage products to modern ones. They found that things today are actually cheaper when adjusted for inflation, but the quality has tanked. The real problem is not just that things are worse, it is that determining quality has become nearly impossible.
Exactly. You cannot just trust a brand name anymore, because the brand has likely been hollowed out by private equity or a massive holding company. The visual cues of quality are still there, but the materials are terrible. It is a phenomenon we are seeing across the board, from power tools to home appliances to clothing. The playbook is always the same. Acquire the brand, optimize the costs, extract the brand equity, and sell off the husk.
It is a depressing reality of modern consumerism, but understanding how the game is played at least helps you make better purchasing decisions. Do your research, ignore the logo, and look at the actual materials.
That is great advice to end on. That wraps up our coverage for today. Thank you so much for tuning in to HN Pod.
We will be back tomorrow with another breakdown of the top stories from Hacker News. Until then, happy coding, and maybe double check the zippers before you buy your next backpack.